IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. My name is Rohan Seth, and generally in this podcast, we have a lot of discussions around tech, antitrust in general, and I have to do a lot of speaking along with my friend and colleague Anupam. But thankfully, this time around, you won't have to hear us because we have an actual expert with us, Mihir Mahajan. Mihir, say hello.
Hello, everyone. It's nice to be here.
We're going to be talking about history in this podcast, specifically the Microsoft antitrust case from the 1990s. I think it's not specifically the 1990s. I think it started back in the 1980s, late 80s, but I think we can get into that. But let's begin with the question, shall we? So first thing, Mihir, I think we talked about this at a work meeting a few weeks ago, and I wanted the listeners to know this. We generally think about the Microsoft case as this one giant antitrust battle. And when it was, in fact, three battles, spanning from Windows 95 to Internet Explorer. So tell me a little bit more about that. Give me some background. What are these three cases that we should know about?
Right. So in fact, it's not three separate cases. It's more than that. There were multiple private, public. So antitrust in the United States, a case can be brought up by multiple different kinds of parties. The obvious one that a lot of people know about is the Department of Justice that conducts the antitrust investigations. And that was kind of taking the action on the Internet Explorer context. But private parties, such as competitors, can also bring antitrust suits, as well as consumers. End consumers in the United States under the class action doctrine can also say, I have been harmed because of a monopoly, and bring a case against a company. So in the case of Microsoft, multiple different lawsuits were brought up in the late 80s throughout up until the early 2000s on the various different dominant products that Microsoft had in the market at that time. So it's not just three cases, it's several cases.
These several cases that you talk about, so one of them is the Internet Explorer case, right? So Netscape Navigator, which was at the time a very hotshot company, doing well in the first phase of the browser wars. But then Microsoft comes up with this product called Internet Explorer. So how does this thing shape up? Like, does Microsoft tie this with Office? What was the deal here and how did it go?
Right. So I think the key question in an antitrust case is whether competition is being harmed. And the key allegation there was that by bundling Internet Explorer, which is a graphical internet browser product, with Windows, which is a dominant desktop operating system of the 90s, Microsoft essentially was foreclosing the market for any other third-party browser provider, and Netscape being the primary one. But there were also additional browser providers back then. But the key question there was, therefore, are there separate markets for desktop or laptop class operating systems from internet browsers? And Microsoft's contention was that Windows has network browsing capability already. You could use Windows to browse files on an internal network of a company. And the internet browsing capability is just extending that network from a local area network or a within company network to the broader internet. And therefore, capability to browse the internet should be built into the operating system. And that's why we have Internet Explorer bundled into the OS. Netscape, on the other hand, or the US DOJ, on the other hand, was claiming that these two are separate markets, that an operating system is separate from an internet browser. And therefore, bundling something into the operating system where you have a monopoly is cause for concern because the monopoly is likely to be extended through the bundling into the market for internet browsers.
All right. And I remember there was this one point where you mentioned that Microsoft went to great lengths to basically say that there is no Windows without Internet Explorer. So they basically tried to mangle up the code in a way that makes it look like Internet Explorer is basically this core part of Windows. And then people had to basically make sense of the code and say that, listen, you just forced this together and this is literally not how this works. Am I correct in, is my very nuanceless statement correct?
I think you're largely correct. Maybe what will help is to go back into the additional previous antitrust situations that Microsoft had faced and what it had learned from that and that, how that influenced how Internet Explorer was sold. So prior to this Windows Internet Explorer bundling, Microsoft had faced additional other antitrust lawsuits. So one of the important ones was in the context of Windows 95. So to give our listeners a real kind of look at history, back in the 80s when the IBM PC first was developed and made popular, the PC x86 architecture from Intel, the Intel x86 architecture provided the processor. IBM came up with the initial architecture of how that processor was going to be put on a motherboard, put together with other components like displays and floppy disk and hard disk drives and serial ports to connect printers and so on into a personal computer that could be on your desktop. The piece that IBM was missing was an operating system or software for the machine architecture that they had developed. IBM was a dominant mainframe company. It was building mainframe computers. It didn't have an operating system that could run on the very low capacity Intel processor, if you will. So it cast out a net and essentially identified Microsoft as a supplier for operating systems for IBM PCs. Therefore, came into being Microsoft DOS, or what we knew as MS-DOS back then. And MS-DOS was a, like back in the 80s, in the absence of graphical displays or those being very expensive, MS-DOS was essentially a console operating system. You got a command prompt and you put in commands there to start various software. And let's say you started Lotus 1-2-3, or you could start a word processor like a WordStar or a WordPerfect. And then that software also had a text-based user interface. There were no vector graphics on the screen in most of this software. So at that time, an operating system was essentially thought of as what DOS stood for, disk operating system. The operating system allowed you to boot up a computer, load software, load files from a floppy disk or a hard drive, and save files there. And some operating systems had additional capability, like printing documents or connecting to a network and so on. But in the very early days of disk operating systems, the core functionality was being able to drive the processor, load stuff in memory, and write stuff to disk. That was all what operating system was called. So when this kind of, from the 80s, when we move into the early 90s, Microsoft realized that graphics was the way of the future. Apple, back in the mid 80s, already had machines that had a graphical user interface, but they were relatively limited and the sales of those machines were relatively limited. They were expensive. But Microsoft recognized that future and built a graphical UI on top of Windows. On top of DOS, I mean. So up until the late 80s, Microsoft only had DOS. Then they built a separate graphical user interface, which was essentially like an application on top of Windows. So you could have DOS without Windows, and you could just install Windows separately and run Windows. And then within Windows, you could run programs that required graphics. So there were some very preliminary games or graphic processing software that was used. At Windows 95, at the launch of Windows 95, what Microsoft did is essentially they combined the two and sold it as one product. So prior to Windows 95, you could buy Microsoft DOS and you could buy Windows separately. At Windows 95, they sold the two things together as one product. And obviously, there were antitrust complaints essentially saying that the GUI is a separate product from the disk operating system and Microsoft has merged them. And Microsoft had to go through a lot of kind of arguments back and forth to try to show that the UI was an integral part of the OS. Because even as late as Windows 95, Windows 95 had the DOS command prompt inside. And there were many, many parts of DOS that were retained as is. And only very little integration of the UI with the OS had happened in terms of the technology. So when that happened, the allegations of extending the monopoly from a disk operating system into a GUI got Microsoft in trouble, where they realized that this kind of argument could be brought forth for any other change to the operating system that added to functionality. So when they launched Windows with Internet Explorer, I think Windows 98 was the first version that Internet Explorer had built in, they commingled the code. The code in Windows 98 was analyzed by experts. And what you could see is you couldn't tell apart what code was Windows and what code was Internet Explorer. The motivation for doing that, my hunch is that stemmed from their prior antitrust struggles.
All right. That's sort of, typical behavior in some sense, according to me at least. This other bit of typical behavior that I actually wanted to also ask you about is generally when we see a company being accused of a monopoly, there is this set process that is followed in a lot of countries, which is you define a relevant market, you define this company is dominant in the market, and then you say that this dominance has been abused. And I think this is a very American way of doing it. Indians have a slightly different way. But given this case, and I don't know if you remember this particular bit, but what was the relevant market defined in this antitrust case? Was it operating systems, licensable operating systems? Could you elaborate on that, please?
Right. So I think for the benefit of the listeners, I think it's important to understand that the word market, as you and I understand it as generalists versus as how antitrust people understand it, has different meanings. So the word market is used in the context of market analysts or in the context of players in the market and so on. And how we generally understand it is a market is where you can buy things and things that are similar compete in the same market. So for example, if you think about internet browsers, today we can say that the Firefox browser and Microsoft's Edge browser and Google's Chrome browser and all of those are essentially providing very similar functionality, which is that they allow you to access the internet and therefore they are in the same market. However, the way antitrust experts define market is slightly different. So this is kind of a generalist understanding that these things compete with each other and therefore are in the same market. However, the way an antitrust expert would assess a market is to understand whether there is to what extent there is substitutability between products that are alleged to be in the same market. Essentially, if there are enough products and enough with market share that are substitutable with each other, then the antitrust expert may be able to conclude that these products are substitutable and are therefore, if any of the product suppliers were to perform an anti-competitive action, then users would be able to simply switch from one product to another. So, for example, if let's say a particular credit card provider increases the fees, then maybe users can switch to other banks that provide the same kind of credit card. And so on. So in a competitive market, there exists a fair number of substitutes and users can substitute freely between the products. So therefore, there is no additional profit to be earned. It's not profitable for a provider, for a participant in the market to take anti-competitive actions like raising prices or reducing product quality and so on. Because anything that is in a competitive market, these things are not profitable. So the people won't take that action. However, if a market participant is a monopolist, the monopolist is able to take actions such as performing a small increase in price and have that change be profitable because customers may not necessarily have an ability to switch. There may not be enough or suitable substitutes for what the product is. So what an antitrust expert does is essentially starts with a market definition that may be, for example, in the Microsoft case, may have been, is there a market for Microsoft Windows, right? The definition could be as small as that. And the answer could be yes, for example, if it is determined that a lot of people have bought software that runs only on Windows and have bought computers that only run Windows and therefore are unable to switch from Windows to another operating system simply because they would have to buy all this other software again or because the other operating system is inferior in some way or the other. But whichever way it is, if a user's ability to substitute away from Windows into another operating system is limited and constrained to the extent that the operating system provider, in this case Microsoft, is able to profitably raise prices, then that could be a properly defined market. So Windows could have been a properly defined market. So in the 90s, when the market definition was conducted for Windows, The predominant paradigm of sales was the OEM channel. Essentially, Microsoft sold Windows to OEMs such as Dell or IBM or Hewlett Packard or any of the hardware companies at that time. Those companies loaded the operating system onto a computer and sold it to end consumers. So at that time, the market could have been talked about as licensable operating system for desktop PCs or laptop PCs. In this case, what ended up happening is Windows itself was kind of found to be a market because there was no operating system available that could that was deemed a reasonable price constraining substitute on Windows. So while other operating systems like Apple's macOS existed, there were a few others, kind of hobbyist kind of operating systems out there, they were not deemed to be substitutes that could price constrain Microsoft. So Windows itself was identified as a market.
That is astounding. Thank you so much, Mihir. I think that's the most comprehensive answer anyone's ever given on All Things Policy. So, and like I say that in the best way possible, because as you were saying, I had questions that were answered in the next sentence. So thank you for that. I want to sort of move on from what the case was to the implications of the case. And so as someone who was a product of the 1990s, I understand browser wars as like 1990s was the first phase of the browser wars, which is having a Netscape navigator and then having Internet Explorer. And then like this whole other segment where there's Opera and Firefox and Chrome and like now there's Safari. So what was the impact of the antitrust case on the first round of these browser wars, which is having the Netscape navigator versus Internet Explorer? Do we still face these impacts today? How did that thing go?
That's actually a very good question, because one of the common critiques, and I don't think it's unjust, of antitrust action in high technology industries is that antitrust regulators don't understand technology or don't understand the rate at which technology changes and how product boundaries can vanish. Product boundaries that exist today can vanish tomorrow. So that's a very common critique, and a lot of people refer to the Microsoft case from that critical angle. When looking back, one should not have kind of a hindsight is 2020 kind of aspect. One should put oneself in the late 90s when the case was active and evaluate it from that perspective, rather than saying, well, how the market shaped up in the next 20 years tells us that an action was good or bad. So just putting myself in the late 90s, what I can tell you is that Microsoft was identified as by far the largest and most dominant software company in the world, personal software, especially when it came to personal computing. And if you look at that, the way Microsoft arrived at that position in the late 90s was that they had successfully kind of done multiple things. Back in the 80s, they were a very small company that was selected by IBM to build a disk operating system. They were competing very heavily with other companies like Borland and Corel and WordPerfect and many others for the market for software such as word processing, spreadsheets, presentation software, and things of that nature. And in many of these markets, there were really, really good products. There was WordPerfect, WordStar, Microsoft Word, and a few other word processors in the 80s. What had happened throughout the 90s really was that Microsoft had successfully, and it can be debated whether it was legal, illegal, whichever way, and there were multiple lawsuits on it. Microsoft had successfully captured very, very large market shares and dominant market shares in many different software products. So Microsoft Windows was the dominant operating system. Microsoft Office was the dominant Office productivity suite. And between the two, between the Windows and the Office monopolies, if you will, Microsoft essentially had consumers like you and I with no alternatives left. The only possible alternative would have been for us to maybe buy an Apple machine, which was way more expensive. And open source was not this big. There was really no real Linux in the mid-90s that was commercially usable. There was no open office kind of initiative. So even though Corel and Borland and IBM kept selling some of these products, Microsoft was really the dominant player and was reaping very, very high profits, and therefore kind of continuing to kind of be feared in the software industry. So the antitrust authorities, when they stepped in to the whole Internet Explorer situation, there was a lot of support from other players in the software industry, because they were seeing that Microsoft was, what it was doing or was alleged to be doing, was using the power it had, because Windows was on every person's computer, to put in more and more and more stuff into their device. So initially they put in the GUI, then they put in the browser. And people are afraid that Microsoft was going to continue to leverage this. And similarly, Office was dominant, and Microsoft had essentially constructed Office out of a diverse suite of products. Excel and Word were sold separately in the early 90s. PowerPoint was sold separately, even in the late 90s. But Microsoft had managed to kind of combine the three and say that this is an Office productivity suite. So even if you needed a word processor, you had to buy the whole thing. So people were really afraid that Microsoft was going to continue to dominate the industry. And there was an inflection point. The internet was seen as an inflection point. If you read Bill Gates' book from the mid-90s, The Road Ahead, he actually talks about all the different things that the internet might bring up. And the browser was seen as the gateway to the internet. And Netscape had kind of jumped in early and built a very good product in terms of being able to browse the internet. And therefore, a lot of people were building things on top of Netscape, in some sense, building websites that allowed people to do things. So things like Hotmail and others were essentially starting to be substitutes for products that were on the desktop. Microsoft recognized this as a potential existential threat, that with Netscape and the widespread availability of web-based services, maybe Windows itself would weaken, and it was Microsoft's cash cow in some sense. So they needed to, one, protect Windows, and then two, kind of capture or try to capture as much of the market from internet-based products, and built Internet Explorer into Windows. So the regulator had to step in, or have felt that they had to step in, because this inflection point was an opportunity for the regulator to potentially limit what kind of dominance Microsoft would acquire in various internet-based products on internet markets by controlling the gateway, which was Internet Explorer. So I think to the extent that I think I can comment on the results, but I want to let you see if you have any question at this point.
It's more of an observation than a question, really, because the way you describe Microsoft is something that I've already seemed to have forgotten, because I think I take it for granted today, like Microsoft's a gentle giant and so on, but I just forget how ruthless as a company Microsoft used to be, and how Apple basically did not exist, at least in India, for an 8-year-old. There was no Mac OS operating system that people were using. So it's truly just astounding how this has turned out. So yeah, I mean, it's not a question, just as much as reminiscing
over. You're absolutely right. There is a generation of people that now are technology users who have not realized how dominant Microsoft was in the 90s and how much of a worry worldwide there was over Microsoft. We see the same kind of worries for other tech companies today, but Microsoft was kind of the big one back in that period. So in terms of what happened with the antitrust efforts is there was a ruling at one point to break up Microsoft into two companies. And there was an attempt to kind of separate Internet Explorer. The European authorities actually required Microsoft to, for every computer sold in Europe, to essentially offer a choice screen when you initially installed a machine or when you initially configured the machine, to say continue using Internet Explorer or switch to Netscape or any of the other browsers that were available. So the choice screen was an effort on the European authorities' part to kind of promote competitiveness in the browser space. What I think ended up happening was Microsoft paid very, very large fines back in the late 90s, early 2000 period, both to the to various authorities around the world, the government authorities, but also in class action lawsuits. So I remember various US consumers in various state courts, in California, in Michigan, in Iowa, in Florida, all of these states, consumer class actions were brought in, essentially alleging that Microsoft was a monopolist in the Windows and Office markets and was overcharging customers. In the absence of competition to those products, customers were paying way higher than they would have, than they should have been. And Microsoft paid billions of dollars in damages. And what that did is, between those billions of dollars of damages and years of litigation, two things happened. Microsoft's ability to kind of behave and merge software was somewhat hampered because there was antitrust scrutiny on it. Second was its attention to the specific technology trends probably slipped because executives were to some extent dragged into this litigation. And that created a window for where Internet Explorer was actually not a very good product in the mid-2000s, in the early to mid-2000s. A lot of people will remember this, is Internet Explorer was a terrible product. It used to crash a lot. It was not compliant with all kinds of web standards, and it was slow and so on. And that left room for a lot of new kind of browser software companies to come up. And that's when I think the open source software Firefox came in, the European software Opera came in, Google's Chrome came in. And many of these products were superior in pure technical terms. And also as internet companies like Yahoo and Google and Facebook and many others came up in the early 2000s to the early 2010s, they kind of realized that by having browsers separate from the OS, they were free from Microsoft's influence to some extent. And web services itself kind of became a big thing. So the desktop monopoly being extended into the internet kind of stopped being a threat. So I think it's as a combination of Microsoft being distracted or not competent and upstarts having an opportunity to compete on relatively fair terms because Microsoft had been kind of punished in some sense.
The bit about Internet Explorer not being great is something I can relate to, not just because of the meme culture, but I also remember distinctly when Opera came out in the first, I was quite enthused to get Opera and Chrome. And I remember Opera had, so how you have bookmarks now, Opera had this home screen where you could just click on like this huge image of the website that you frequented. And Opera used to call it speed dial. And I thought that was so, archaic, because it's like speed dial was something that phone still had, but like to make that connect was something that I thought was, at the time I thought it was cool, but now I feel like it was trying to, a bit archaic.
Yeah, but Opera, I'm happy that you remember Opera, because Opera was my primary browser of choice from 2003 to 2007 or 8, and it was very fast, it was very efficient. And in fact, it had a built-in email client. It had a built-in email client that was so good that people forget that email clients are very important. Now we all use web-based email. But back in the day when we had server-based email, Opera was actually a terrific and fast email client as well. And Opera continues to be a good browser. I think up until about a few years ago, a lot of European customers as well as customers in Africa and even in India, we used to have Opera on their phones. So Opera did make the transition as well. And I think the whole Microsoft situation gave opportunity to a lot of small companies to build in. I mean, the innovation that happened in the browsers in the early 2000s has a lot to owe to the fact that there was competition in the marketplace, that a lot of people were trying to build browsers for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, well, the forgotten era that is Opera is, it's quite a tragedy. But I mean, as I record this on Chrome, my sympathies to the good people there. But this sort of brings me to a couple of final questions in some sense. So the first one is generally antitrust efforts sort of seem to fixate on this idea that harm basically consists of raising prices for consumers. So as you mentioned, like if there is a monopoly and it raises prices, people have nowhere else to go, they'll stick, and the monopolies can basically increase its profits by doing that. And yet, like, this is where the tech bit sort of comes in, because in Microsoft's case, Internet Explorer was free. Like, I'm doing air quotes here, even though like Microsoft was bent on destroying competition with it. Like, how do you imagine this standard will evolve over time? How do you think it should evolve over time?
I think that's a good question. There's a clarification I'd like to make. So Netscape, at least initially, was a chargeable product. It had a price. You had to pay a few dollars to download and install and run Netscape on your machine. And Internet Explorer was free in the sense that they didn't have a price attached to it. But I think you forget that the Internet Explorer was bundled with Windows. And Windows being a monopolist product, Microsoft had a lot of pricing flexibility around Windows, right? So when you think about when a product is free, what you don't necessarily look at is what bundle is it a part of and what is the allocation of that to Internet Explorer. So in fact, I remember when we did this analysis back in the early 2000s, Microsoft, one of the ways that economists kind of assess whether damages are due to consumers is to kind of compare the prices or compare the profitability of individual products with benchmarks. So in the consumer class actions, for example, in the Microsoft case, one of the ways to think about it is, one, you have to prove that there's a monopoly, that there is a monopoly on Windows or there's a monopoly on Office. Second, one has to prove that that monopoly was caused by certain illegal actions, and those actions could be of a different nature. And then third is that because there was a monopoly and because it was illegal, some damages are owed to the end customers. So just referring to the damages to the end customers for the Windows part, I can tell you that one of the ways to do it is benchmark profitability of a monopolist product like Windows to profitability of other Microsoft products from the same time period, right? So if Microsoft was a very efficient company at generating high quality software and selling it, one wouldn't expect that the efficiency of the company would differ between its Windows division and its Office division and its division that was making other software. But what if you benchmark it that way, what came out was that Windows and Office were possibly way more profitable as products than other products that Microsoft itself was developing. What that told you is that with the same level of efficiency and same quality of developers, certain products were more profitable than others, which meant that even though Internet Explorer was free or Windows or Office as a bundle was relatively low priced compared to just individual word processors, the bundle itself was a monopolist product and could be alleged or could be proven or shown to have a higher price. So the fact that a product is bundled or given away for free isn't necessarily a guarantee, because in that case, Internet Explorer's price was rolled into Windows, so it wasn't free.
Okay, yeah, that helps. Thanks. The other question that I sort of wanted to, it's more of a tidbit, because I think we discussed it in one of our old meetings and you explained it really well, so I wanted our listeners to know this also. But in general, antitrust cases talk about a relevant market, which you've mentioned before. And there's always a geographical underpinning to that. So like if you read a CCI report, or if you read the recent Texas report, the antitrust case, the reports will basically say that company X has relevant markets in XX and in India or the US. And like they'll say that this relevant market is the US. They'll say the relevant market is India, which is sort of weird to me, because like, for example, Internet Explorer, right? It did not adhere to geography. Like I, as an Indian kid, had Internet Explorer, as did someone back in the US. So where does this sort of geographical nature of the market come from in the complaint, especially when it comes to tech? Because to me, it seems a little bit like a relic. So what's the context to this?
Right. I think the simple answer, there is a simple answer and there's a complex answer. The simple answer is that whoever brings a lawsuit, a monopolization lawsuit, has to bring it in some jurisdiction. So in the US, the individual states have their own competition laws, and you could bring in a lawsuit and then you would say that the market at least is in that state. There are federal antitrust laws like the Sherman Antitrust Act, where you would actually have to show that the offense was performed across more than in the US geography. So in the Microsoft case or in many other US litigation, to bring a lawsuit under US law, under US federal law, you have to show that a monopoly and a bad action, alleged violation of law, happened in the geography to which the law applies. There is no way that a Competition Commission of India can bring action against a product that is not sold in India, right? There is no harm done to Indians if there was no price gouging or any kind of bad action under Indian law. So I think the simple answer is that while the tech products may be sold worldwide or in large markets, the geographic underpinning is required because the reach of law is limited. The second part of it is that the geographic market also allows you to constrain the market definition in ways that you can exclude substitutes that are not available to users in the US. So when you define the United States market, for example, like one good way to think about it is that due to the US trade statutes, companies like Google are restricted from selling certain technologies in China. So for example, Chinese manufacturer Huawei has been sanctioned and can no longer, if my understanding is right, Google is therefore not allowed to officially license its version of Android to Huawei. So what that means is Chinese consumers who buy Huawei phones in China are not going to be able to get Google's version of Android, and therefore it doesn't act as a price constraining aspect for phone operating systems in China. So when there is a product that is not available or that doesn't act as a substitute in the geography, you need to exclude that. So even like in physical markets, if something's sold in Bangalore, then it acts as a price constraining substitute. But if its price is relatively small, you're not going to drive to Mysore just to constrain competition. So geographic markets matter in a lot of antitrust cases where the distance constrains what is substitutable and what is not. That's the origin of the geographic limit. Obviously, in tech markets, that doesn't apply, and It's everything's a click away and so on.
That's extremely lucid. So thank you. Thank you for that. I don't have any more questions.
Let me turn this over, Rohan. I mean, I think it's been a one-way discussion and you put me on the spot. Let me put you on the spot here. And maybe kind of for the listeners' benefit, like the Competition Commission of India has been very active over the last 3 or 4 years, especially in various tech markets. So I do want to kind of understand what kinds of inquiries or actions has the Competition Commission of India conducted over the last 3 or 4 years in the tech markets?
I've seen a bunch of them in the tech markets, actually. I think if I just go by platform, there's been stuff from Amazon. So I think there's one complaint on Amazon using CloudTail and its preferred distributors that severely damaged the sales of a company called Beverly Hills Polo Club. I'm not entirely sure. We did an episode on this and it's quite a bizarre episode because they kept saying they were never on Amazon, but then Amazon had other people that were selling stuff that is substitutable and so on. So one area that they've been looking at is platform neutrality on the e-commerce front. The other bit that I thought was interesting was someone brought a complaint to the CCI about WhatsApp Pay. And I think that complaint was a bit ahead of its time. We recorded a podcast on that as well. Because see, the CCI was happy to look into it. But the issue was that WhatsApp Pay isn't actually out as a product yet. And that's sort of jumping the gun as far as complaints go. So they've been looking at that. And there's also something regarding Google, I think Google Pay and Phone Pay. And so a complaint alleged three markets. I think one of them was Google's dominant in Android operating systems. And then Google Pay is the dominant mode on the Play Store. And that specifically talked about why Google prefers Google Pay on the Play Store. So this is a very tongue-twisting statement. But the basic idea is that Google bundles these two together, if I'm not wrong. I think I might be getting the terminology wrong a little. But and that the CCI, or most of it has been thrown out by the CCI because, well, in the WhatsApp case, the idea is that WhatsApp Pay isn't a dominant product yet. I mean, the market's been defined. And on the Google front, Google Pay isn't actually, like, there was stuff that editor's choice lists, etc., were being rigged on the Play Store, but that hasn't been proven. And like the only sort of credible thing that the informant had on that Google Pay case was that they had screenshots of Google Pay being dominant, and then Google came up with their own screenshots, and the CCI was like, listen, I can't decide this case based on screenshots. So that pretty hilarious report. And so my big takeaway from the CCI stuff basically is that the debates are moving forward a little bit. And what I mean by that basically is that I recently read this book called The Curse of Bigness by Tim Wu. Mm-hmm. And in that he explains, Professor Wu explains, that we generally always did not assume that competition was good. And it took over 100 years or more for that to be considered as just a given truth, right? Because you had Rockefeller and people saying that, listen, if we don't have competition, we do really well. Maybe we do better than we have competition. And it took over 100 years and a Teddy Roosevelt for us to get here. And I feel like that's basically the time span we're looking at here. I mean, yes, CCI orders are making progress. Yes, we're defining markets more, and those definitions might be something that we can use later on. But that's my broad takeaway. I think this is a long, long-winded battle and something that is going to need steady progress. It may be decided in the favor of one side or the other, but the time span, it's long, and we've sort of started making steady progress. That's my broad takeaway from this.
I think the key points you made are that one, that antitrust is becoming more and more important in India because and especially tech antitrust, because we are a large market. We have a robust legal system that can deal with issues, and India is seen as a market for a lot of companies, global companies as well as domestic companies, to compete in, and ensuring a level playing field for both Indian players as well as global players that participate in our economy, that help us with things like, I mean, it's remarkable what competition has produced and what technology has produced. like from a time of a cash only economy to now having a substantial portion of our GDP or of our transactions being carried over entirely digital platforms. A lot of those platforms and technologies being indigenously built, as the UPI stack is. A lot of authentication technologies being used and so on. I think India is a very attractive market, both for our innovative people that can build products and for our consumer class that kind of is willing to try out new things and help push boundaries and move things forward. So ensuring a competitive marketplace as through a robust and reliable process, whether it's the CCI or the courts, is important. And I think focus on the economics of it, the protection of competition, which kind of tends to produce lower prices, which tends to produce greater variety and choice for consumers and improve the product quality, can ensure that as ordinary consumers, we have access to the best products at the lowest price. And the CCI should take that economic role, or other regulatory authorities should take that economic role to heart and ensure that that competition rules and we get those benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% with you.
And there's a lot to learn from the Microsoft case to kind of know what to do and what economics to use. So my only kind of key takeaway is that economics matters, and economics can give you very, very good answers on market participation and industrial organization.
On that unusually hopeful note on the power of economics, which Anupam will be very happy to hear, thank you so much, Mihir, for joining us. And thank you all for listening to All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.